All right, so we're gonna talk about quantum logic. And before talking about quantum logic, we need to talk about classical logic. And I'm not sure if you've taken a look before at classical logic with thermodynamics in mind, but just in case, I mean, it's not gonna be just a high school course on this. These are the logical gates and so on. No, it's gonna be a bit more. We're gonna discuss a little bit, right? So hopefully it will be entertaining, even if you think that this is kind of trivial content. So we'll see. I'm writing here, I'm starting to write several logic gates. For example, I mean, this is a logic gate is a map, right, that maps a number of bits, classical bits, to a number of classical bits, right? You have inputs and you have outputs. And there are famous ones that you know, right? Like NOT gate, the negation of the input. So represented like this. And basically, if the input is a zero, well, you get a one. If the input is a one, then you get a zero. Very easy. All right, this single bit gate, I don't care that much about this one, but it's good to have it. This is the OR gate. The OR gate is two inputs and two outputs. Okay, if the input is at least one of them one, then you get a one, otherwise you get a zero. And typically represented like that. Notice that we do nothing on A and B gets the function. Make sense, everybody? It's important that we have two inputs and two outputs. Okay, nobody dies. Through the gate. Make sense, everyone? All right, the AND gate, of course. AB, AND B. Right, so 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And this is 0, 0, 1, 1. And this is 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay, same kind of scheme. You get the AND gate and A is A and this is A and B. All right. So let's see a couple more or four more rather. A nor B, okay, which is typically represented as A plus B negated, okay, which is literally that. So input and output, right? A, B, A nor B. So 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. And then we have the negation of the OR, right? So 0, 0, 0. So far, nothing new. Yeah.
So why are we all putting 2 bits, like to make it reversible?
We're going to talk about it, yes. It's related to that. But yeah, of course, you output 2 bits. So this is going to be important. And typically, you don't destroy the bits. You have a channel, you do a logical operation. It's a map that we want to see if it's invertible or not, above all, and certainly nothing dies. So the question would be, why are we, if I were doing only one output, the question should have been, why are you outputting only one bit? What happens with the other? What destroys the information there? Make sense? All right, so this is more natural than one output instead of two. All right. So let's do A and B. Okay. And you have input, output, A, B, A, and B. Notation for this one typically is the same as direct sum notation. Oh, this is just notation, huh? Not gonna use it that much, but it's good if in case you see it out there. That's the notation that people doing classical gates use. All right, so we get 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And we get 0, 0, 0, sorry, my bad. It's the same, right? 0, 0, 1, 1. and this is 1, 1, 1, 0. So it's a negation of the and. Okay. I'll do a couple more. All right, so A sort B, typically notated as, oh, did I do? I did the wrong notation, my bad. I use the SOR notation here. The SOR notation is the one that comes with the symbol, and it makes sense because this has actually a mod 2 sum. So, or an exclusive OR, meaning that at least one of them has to be 1, but not both. All right, so this is a sum mod 2. Input, output, A, B, A XOR B. All right, so this is 0, 1, 1, so 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. All right, and 0, 0, 1, 1, and then we get 0, 1, 1, 0. Okay.
Professor?
Yep.
So NOR is A plus B, mod 2, and reverse, right?
Correct.
But then, like, when we have input 1, 1, 1 plus 1, mod 2 is 0. So when you reverse...
Oh, no, NOR is not mod 2. This one is mod 2.
That one is mod 2.
Yeah, that's the one that is the sum mod 2. Make sense? All right.
So what does prime denote?
Not. To me, look at the first one. A prime is a negation. So NOR is the OR negated.
Okay.
Same as AND, NAND. NAND is AND negated.
Okay, yes.
Make sense?
Yeah.
Now, this one, I'm going to draw the scheme because this one is going to be important. It's also called CNOT gate. It's going to be very important when we go quantum. Why is it called the CNOT gate? Well, and it's typically, we're going to represent it like this. You can say A short A, sorry, short B, or A CNOT B. Same thing. And we call it CNOT because it's a control NOT, meaning that depending on the value of A, we negate B or leave it as is. So A is controlling B. What happens with B? If A is 0, we don't touch. If A is 0, we don't touch B. If A is 1, we negate B. Make sense? Everybody? That's why it is a control NOT. It's going to be extremely important for us. Everybody happy with that gate? The short, I'm not going to call it short anymore, but maybe I will. At the beginning, while I do classical logic, but I'm going to be calling it more control NOT. Okay? And finally, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Finally, I'm going to write here the Toffoli gate. So, Toffoli. That takes 3 inputs. So input, output, so we have A, B, C, and then we have A, B, here we have C plus A dot B. Again, this is the symbol of the Toffoli because it's the combination of these operations. Let me write them. So we have 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0. Of course, not going to have enough space. 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. Okay, and then the output, of course, this is the same. So 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0.
I have 0, 1 both, yeah. 1, 0. 1, I got lost. 1, 0. 1, 1. 1, 1. The Toffoli gate is 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0.
Okay. Now, the diagram of this one is very interesting. Represented like that. Because the Toffoli is a doubly controlled knot, or control knot. If you want, you can call it CC knot. If A and B both are ones, then swap C. Otherwise, don't do it. Make sense? So A and B jointly control C. That makes sense? Can tell that the only change of C happens when both are ones, and it's negating C. Let me just call it here, C, C naught. Make sense? Let me define the notion of universal set of gates.
Fishing?
Yep.
Is the controlled, let me say, if I have A or B being that flips, is that a gate of interest as well? Like a controlled
one that I didn't write?
Yes.
No, I mean, it's a gate that you can build with. We're going to talk about universality. Not for our course, no. This is of interest for a reason that we will discuss. Make sense? All right. Universality or universal set of gates. So, a set of gates is universal if it can be used to build any function. F mapping set n I to set I, where n m are, well, m are integers, whatever we want to call that,
integers without the zero. So that means that
f of x1 xn, right, equals some x prime 1 prime to x n prime.
So we call a set of gates universal if we can use it to build any function. And this is interesting, right? Because given a set of universal gates, so you see, for example, to get any function mapping bits, a number of n bits to m bits, which is what that means, maybe we need infinitely many gates. Huh? Who knows? Functions can be very complicated, right? But the answer is that no, not really. We need a finite number. There's different universal sets. And that is very interesting, because once I give you a universal set, you can talk about the notion of circuit complexity, which is a notion that is related with, okay, how many gates, how many times do I need to use gates in the universal set to reproduce the function, you see? In terms of a resource theory, if you want, if you have a finite number of gates that you can use, then a function is more complex the more gates you need to use to build it. Make sense? That is a very important notion. Also, those of you interested in holography nowadays, maybe it's a notion that you should look into. Huh? not going to talk much about it, but I think it's, at this level, it should be trivial to understand what the circuit complexity notion is. Make sense? Yep.
Does n have to be less than or equal to a?
No.
Can I have arbitrary values on the end of the function?
What do you mean arbitrary values? A function of any kind, right? Doesn't have to be bijective, doesn't have to be injective.
If you've got more m than n, then you're going to be creating a longer set of output values than your values. And those extra values could be arbitrary.
Yeah. But if you want to limit it to for simplicity, then we can.
I just don't see how you could do that.
Well, you can make them up. I don't have any logic, but yeah, you're right. Okay, fine. Let's do it like that. M less or equal than n. Okay. Everybody happy with that? All right, so examples. I'm not going to prove universality here, but I'm going to give you examples of different universal set of gates, and I'm going to give you some equivalence between them, just for illustration. Examples of universal sets. Well, first one, and, or, and not. Are a universal set. You can do any function with just those three. It gets better because and not alone are already a universal set. It gets better because XOR and are also a universal set. This is repeated. So there's a typo here. It's repeating gates. NAND alone is a universal set. The same happens with NOR. NOR alone is a universal set. And Toffoli alone is a universal set. This is kind of cool, right? Because imagine that you are a electronics manufacturer, a logic manufacturer, right? And then you want to make computers or whatever. You say, okay, I have to do three different kinds of circuits, three different kinds of semiconductor arrangement, one for R, one for OR, one for NOT. But you know what I can do? I can become really good at doing NAND, for example. And that's actually called NAND logic in electronics, and it exists. So you can do just with implementations of NANDs. If you're really good at implementing NANDs, you build everything with NANDs. And you can have any function. Make sense? I have some examples here for you to see. Examples of equivalence. Can we get XOR from and or a not? Yeah, A XOR B is A and not B or not A and B. You see the gate XOR, if your resources is this, if this is what you can do, well, it's going to have some complexity. Make sense? Can you do OR from just and not? Well, of course I can. I can do anything from universal sets, right? It's a matter of finding it. Well, yeah. A OR B, it's equal to A and B. Oh, no, it's wrong set, sorry. This is not A and not B. There you go, an OR gate. By the way, so if we accept only this set as universal, we just prove that N and NOT are also universal. Make sense? Because we just got the one that was missing in there. Make sense? Everybody, so far. How about getting ore from Anang Shore instead? Right, because that's another universal set. I should be able to do it too. Yeah.
For the output of the function f, did you mean to write x prime to m?
Yeah. And of course. Thank you. Another typo for the notes. All right, we can do or from an answer, and that it would be a or b is equal to a and b XOR a XOR b. A couple more for fun. What about getting, so for example, we know that an and not is universal. Let's prove, knowing that NAND alone is universal, okay? So we need to obtain an AND gate and a NOT gate out of just NAND. And that would prove it's universal, assuming that an and not is universal. Let's do that. So can we do NOT from NAND? Yes, we can. Not A. It's equal to A NAND A. Very easy. What about doing AND from NAND? Yes, we also can. A and B. It's equal to A NAND B NAND A NAND B. There you go. And we prove that the NAND gate alone is a universal set. Again, assuming that somebody proved that N and NOT is a universal set. Make sense? Let's also prove that Toffoli is a universal set on its own. For that, we just need to prove that we can get NAND. So let's just do it. NAND from Toffoli okay, so A NAND B. We're gonna learn how to write circuits. So for this one, I will also write the circuit. We're gonna learn to quantum circuits, right? But in particular, things in Toffoli and control NOT, we really need to, the drawing is gonna be the same. So this is double practice. Okay, N and B. It's equal to NOT. A and B, remember. But this is the same as 1 C naught A and B. And this is exactly equal to Toffoli A, B, 1. So if we draw this as a circuit, we put a 1 in the C, and we have a doubly control knot, a CC knot, the Toffoli on that one. So the output is A, B, Toffoli, A, B, 1, which is the same as NAND, A, NAND, B. Makes sense, everybody? Any questions? This should be pretty straightforward so far. Yeah.
Yeah, so what I see here is that the logics that we covered is for 2 input and then 2 output.
Or 3 inputs and 3 outputs. Yeah.
in general, it just doesn't cover all the functions that you can have.
But covers all the functions with n inputs and m outputs. You can do longer circuits and start crossing gates between them. That's true for quantum as well, so that's very important. I can have a huge 10 inputs and 10 outputs, and it's enough with NANDs. I'm going to start putting NANDs between them, and that gives me any function that mixes all the inputs and all the outputs. Make sense? Any function. So no, this is not limited to 2 or 3. No. This is for as large as you want. 3 billion inputs to 4 billion outputs. You just put NANDs in between, and yeah, you're done. Any function.
Any combination.
What do you mean, any combination?
Zeros. So you want all zeros at the end, right? Because in any of these...
Sure, that's a function, so yeah. You can do it, yes, indeed. Make sense? Everybody? That's the meaning of universal set of gates. That's how computers work. Computers don't have implemented a ton of gates. Just have this one of these universal sets. If you check... you know, for example, NAND logic is a thing. Making computers out of just NANDs is a thing. People do it. It's cheaper. It's really cheap. Yeah.
Is the condition for programmability the same as universality?
Tell me programmability.
Like being able to instruct certain algorithms.
Well, you can do any function. So in that sense, I guess. But I actually don't know the answer because I don't know what programmability is. Sorry.
It was a loosely defined terms.
All right. Anyway, so it's true. I can build any function out of these gates. Now, these gates are not all created equal. There are differences between them. And by the way, there are theorems. If you think about circuit complexity, there are theorems that tell you that the complexity scales the same way for any universal set like this. Okay, so if you have a finite universal set, the complexity scales in similar ways. This is very nice when you have finite inputs and finite outputs. Okay, so that's kind of nice. All right, so let's look at the different gates. NOT. Is that gate reversible? It is. If I know the output, I know the input. Nice. Sadly, NOT is not a universal set. So NOT alone is not enough to do a universal set. Okay. OR. Is OR reversible? Clearly not, because you have two outputs that are the same, and there's different inputs. You cannot invert. If I give you 1, 1, where do you come from? If the output is 1, 1, where do you come from? You don't know. Make sense? So you lost information of where you came from when you go through OR. Make sense, everybody? What about AND? Is it reversible? No. The moment you repeat two outputs, it's not reversible anymore. What about NOR? Is it reversible? No. What about NAND? Is it reversible? No. Repeating outputs again. What about XOR? Is it reversible?
Yes.
XOR is reversible. Sadly, XOR is not a universal set. Only with XOR we cannot do it. And with XOR and NOT we cannot do it. That is not a universal set either. We cannot have everything. And I say, Sally, what about Toffoli? Is Toffoli reversible?
Yes.
Toffoli is reversible. Okay, so here's the thing. Why is this notion of reversibility important? Well, let's talk a bit thermodynamics. When people, way before quantum computing, when people were developing computers, right, one of the big issues of computing and integration, right, is that computers get too hot. They waste a lot of energy, right? Above all, the more you're integrating, the way they were doing it, the more energy they waste. And IBM, in particular, hired a lot of physicists. Why? Well, to think of the problem, okay, how can we do this in a more optimal way? And then we say, well, you know, if we want to compute, if we want to transform the input energy to the computer into an output that is work, an orderly output, right? The best way to do it in a front thermodynamics is doing it reversibly. Because we know that the reversible path is the one that has the optimal balance between work and heat. It's the least heat and the most work. Agreed, everybody? So if you implement computing through reversible processes, you at least theoretically should be able to make it way more efficient. Make sense? That's a whole field that was called reversible computing. It was big. It was really big. Make sense, everybody? So ideally, we would like to do computing with reversible weights. This is the reason why Toffoli has a name. Otherwise, why would not just call it the doubly controlled knot? Because Toffoli is, at the same time, a universal set and reversible. So ideally, you can build a Toffoli computer that is a fully reversible computer, at least theoretically. Does that make sense, everybody? So you want to, your true implementation of your computer, you want to be Toffoli's. Now, that's not the way it is in reality, and you may wonder why, but those are more technical issues that I'm not going to get into. But is the notion of reversible computing understood? Now, it's interesting, right? Because there's something in common between quantum computing and reversible classical computing, which is the idea of quantum computing is that all that you do is unitaries. And unitaries can be inverted. Huh? You don't lose information when you when your elements to do computing are unitaries. Well, you do measurements, that's a different story. You may or may not lose information. But if all your quantum operations are unitaries, they're certainly reversible. Agreed, everybody? So they do share something in common, quantum computing and reversible computing, which is reversibility. Make sense? Now, interesting enough, and related to this, I think it's an interesting thing to get into. One of the people working for IBM solved a problem posed by Maxwell. That was a very cool problem, in my opinion. Are you familiar with the Maxwell daemon? How many of you are familiar with the Maxwell daemon? Hands up, I want to see. So about 80% or so of you. Maxwell found, let me just introduce it because not everybody. How many of you know the solution to the problem of Maxwell, the Maxwell daemon? One, considerably less, two. Okay. All right, so Maxwell, which if hopefully you know, it's one of the founding fathers of statistical mechanics. Putting together mechanics and thermodynamics, which is super cool, explaining thermodynamics with the microscopics. Maxwell is one of my favorite physicists, if not the most. It's the grandfather, or the grandmother, I would even say, more important, of relativity. Relativity is already encoded in electromagnetism. Einstein gave him credit for it. He is also one of the founding fathers of statistical mechanics, key contributor to it. He also invented color photography. Did you know that? There's an old film. There's a brand called Maxwell. It's for a reason. He did invent color photography. He also built a model that explains the pauses in the rings of Saturn, still called Maxwell. Discontinuities, Maxwell pauses in there. Again, Maxwell did many things. Maxwell is pretty cool as a physicist. Anyway, point being that, in particular, of course, electromagnetism is a big step, a conceptual step to make out of just looking at Ampere and Faraday, and it's definitely non-trivial to do that step. Anyway, so Maxwell also found a mental experiment that felt like a counterexample, a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. It's a big deal. The laws of thermodynamics better not be violated, or our understanding of the universe should change a lot. Make sense? So he found the following scheme. Let me put it like that. I'll give you the Maxwell version, and then we can talk about the Szilard version if you want. So say that you have a hot gas here at temperature T1, and then a cold gas here at temperature T2, and then T1 is larger than T2. Okay? The second law of thermodynamics, and they say that this is an insulating thing. The second law of thermodynamics tells you that there are many formulations of the second law, right, that are equivalent. For example, no engine can be more efficient than a Carnot engine operating between two thermal baths. That's one of them. For example, if you define the function of state entropy, you can say, well, entropy can only increase or remain the same in spontaneous processes. That's another formulation of the second law. Another one is that spontaneous heat flows cannot be established between a hot source towards a cold source. That's another one. So heat flows from hot to cold, not the opposite. Agreed? Spontaneously. You can have a refrigerator and an engine that you put work in and then does the opposite, but that's not spontaneous. You have to touch it. That requires work. Spontaneous, not spontaneous, the difference is, does it require work or not? That's the difference. Make sense? Everybody? So Maxwell thought of something like this, and then there's a demon. By the way, you know the difference between a god and a demon? In physics, of course. Not in religion. Religions have different opinions, depending on what religion. A god is an all-powerful being, so a god can change the laws of physics. Make sense? Nice. A demon is less powerful than a god. Demon is not evil. It's not, in physics, it's not associated with evil. So let's not have prejudices coming from religion here. A demon is a powerful being, extremely powerful as it can be, but cannot change the laws of physics. All right? So they can do everything that the laws of physics allow for. So a demon may be able to rearrange the molecules in this room to build a Ferrari or something, but without, whereas a god can just materialize a Ferrari out of nothing. See the difference between a demon and a god? So demon is all-powerful. A demon can do anything the laws of physics allow for. In a way, we strive to become demons, no? When we build technology. That's what we're trying to do. Get to the limit of what the laws of physics allows us to do, no? All right, so the difference is clear then, right? So you have different demons. You have a Lagrange demon. You have a Maxwell demon. Let's talk about the Maxwell demon here. So the Maxwell demon, let me represent it with horns. This is just a prejudicial representation, typically with a trident. In physics, we try to draw it like this, a psi, to be a little bit less prejudicial. Not always. Let me make it actually a happy demon. There we go. So a demon here, this demon can measure the individual position and velocity of every molecule. This is a classical gas, so quantum mechanics doesn't have anything to say here. Can measure the position and the momentum of every particle in here. Agreed? And then the demon also has control over a small trapdoor here, which is ideal, has a negligible amount of work to open it, let's say, okay? As small as you need and the smallest amount of work, negligible as compared to any flows of energy here, so zero, effectively, for our setting. And the demon can, maybe let's say it's a frictionless trapdoor. And the demon can measure what particle is coming here, the velocity of a particle that's coming here. And the demon, if the demon sees a very fast particle, it's going to open the trapdoor. And no, the opposite, because I wrote that balance. So of course, in both cases, you have a distribution of velocities, right? Some of them are faster, some of them are slower, because it's a thermal state gas. Agreed? So when a particle with low velocity comes in here, a velocity that is below the average of the velocities here, the demon doesn't touch the trapdoor, and pew, the particle bounces back and stays here. Make sense? If the demon sees a very fast particle, then the demon opens the trapdoor, and the particle comes in here. This demon is spending no work. Agreed? Opening the trapdoor costs zero work, or as close to zero as you want. Epsilon work, but it's negligible with the flows of energy. And suddenly, without the cost of work, you're getting a heat flow, well, an energy flow coming from the cold source to the hot one. Make sense? Hence, violating the second law of thermodynamics. And in practice, if you wanted to build it yourself, you just need this to be more efficient than a Carnot pump, going from the toilet. It requires less work than the Carnot pump. But Maxwell looks at it and says, well, in principle, I see no reason why this couldn't exist. And this would be a counterexample of the second law. And everybody was like, holy crap, you're right. Make sense, everybody? And we understand what the Maxwell demon is. Szilard actually simplified it a lot because you don't need a full gas. You can have just one particle. And then you can have a piston on both sides, two pistons on both sides, right? And then if the particle is here, if it bounces through this piston, right, it will give work on here. If the particle bounces here, it will be giving you a work here. And the idea is, well, we need to measure on what side of the box the particle is, and then place the piston consistently. And we move the piston, and we always extract work. You see, you formulate it as the opposite, even like, well, you can keep extracting work from the same thermal bath, one thermal bath. again, violating the second law of thermodynamics in the Carnot formulation. Make sense? So this is the problem of the Maxwell demon. Yep.
Can you just rotate by 180 degrees, and then you get your hot wire coils and your cold wire coils?
What, sorry?
If you just rotate the entire device, then you can reverse.
No, but then again, this is system A and system B. Where you place them?
You can't switch them. You can switch them.
This is not about switching them. This is about establishing a heat flow between them. All right? I don't care which one is on the left and on the right. Okay, so this is the problem of the Maxwell demon, and it was a big problem in thermodynamics and in physics. And it was solved by one of these people that IBM hired to work on reversible computing. IBM, by the way, had a journal back in the day. It was called Blue Skies, and actually a lot of particle physicists published there, which is interesting. Huh? IBM had this mentality that Google, that, you know, I'll give you 2 days a week to do whatever you want. That already existed, and better. Back in the 50s and the 60s, well, in the 60s, the beginning of computing, right? And it was better because it was truly you can do whatever you want. And they did high energy physics, and sometimes they hire physicists just, well, you do your physics, it's fine. It's a prestige thing. So it's no longer the case. I don't think high energy physicists are hired to do high energy physics at Google, for example, nowadays. Maybe wrong, huh? But as far as I know, I don't know any. Anyway, so. The person was Landauer, and Landauer solved the Maxwell demon issue by thinking about reversible computing, which is super cool. You know, in computing, sorry, you can do functions with reversible gates, we already discussed it, but there's one thing that you will never, ever be able to do reversibly that we need in computing. Care to guess what it is? What is a process in computing? Think of your computer, things that you do with your computer, okay? Regular things that you do with your computer. Do you know of one that can never be reversible?
Deletion?
Yes. When you erase something, better not be reversible or you haven't deleted it. Make sense? You want to free up memory because you want to use it for something else. If you are not erasing the information, you're still keeping it in memory. Make sense? So erasure has to be non-reversible by definition, okay? And I'm not gonna get into what Landauer did. It's actually very easy, but it will take me a lecture maybe. But Landauer thought of, okay, there's gonna be, because erasure is non-reversible, there's gonna have to be a heat loss always in erasure. It's a non-reversible process. We know there's gonna have to be a heat loss. What is the best case scenario? What is the smallest amount of energy that I need to spend to reverse something, to erase something? Make sense? And Landauer found an expression for it. It's related to the Shannon. It's actually KB, the Shannon entropy, that you added by deleting. So it's so cool because another case, remember when I related the von Neumann entropy with thermodynamics, saying like information is physical. Here's a much better example. Information is physical. You can say that the cost of erasing a number of bits has to always be larger or equal than the right constants in front of the dimensional constants, right? KT, KBT, in front of the Shannon entropy. Make sense, everybody? So that's super cool, actually, and nice. So he proved the minimal cost of erasure, at least classically. Make sense? In quantum mechanics, you can actually spend entanglement to cheat that, but they didn't have entanglement. Make sense? Okay. How does that solve the Maxwell demon problem? I mean, those of you who know the solution, of course, know how, but you're not allowed to play here for this one. Anybody has any idea how that solves the Maxwell demon problem? Okay. So imagine that I do the Maxwell demon problem and I keep track of how much work. I do the Szilard version, that is easier, okay? With one particle here or here, I need to measure where the particle is, and by knowing that, I know where to place the piston to extract work. And I can compute how much work, actually. It's easy to compute it. Thermodynamically, I can compute how much work using just regular thermodynamics. You have a number of the work that the demon is extracting out of just knowing where the particle is. You could do the same with this, right? You could do with the full Maxwell. You can compute as well how much energy you are, how much work you're extracting here. Anyway, and does anybody see how Landauer helps here? No? Well, the daemon has to know where the particle is, right? That's information. So once he looks at it, he needs to act. Looks at the information and needs to act. Agreed? It's a causal chain. First needs to look at the information, then needs to act. Agreed? So the daemon has to store the information somewhere. Agreed, everybody? If you want to run this as an engine, it's called a Zeller engine, actually. If you want to run this as an engine, you need to be able to cycle the process and do it many times. So in the end, you need to reset everything to the beginning. Or a different thing, if you're not interested in the engine, if you want to keep doing it, you have to store the value many times to keep doing it, right? If you want to run it as a cycle, you need to reset the whole thing. You're going to have to erase the information that you acquire, the velocity and the position of the particle, or what side of the box it is. Agreed? You can say, well, not really. You don't have to, because it's a little of information. Sure, sure. Eventually, you'll have to if you keep doing it. Agreed? If you compute the minimal amount of energy that it costs to erase that information, it's exactly equal to the work extracted by the contraption. So thermodynamically, you're extracting no work. All the work that you're extracting is going to be spent into erasing the memory, resetting the system back to the original point to do an engine. Hence, solving the problem of the Maxwell daemon and safekeeping the second law of thermodynamics. I mean, you don't seem excited, but I'm going to assume you are inside, because this is super cool. This is cool stuff. And it took more than half a century to actually solve the problem. And it's Landauer working for IBM and thinking of reversible computing that solved the problem of the Maxwell daemon. Before the problem, before that, nobody knew how to solve the problem of the Maxwell daemon. It was a contradiction of the second law, and people say, maybe one day we'll be able to beat these daemons and beat the, build the door, a trap door, and do it, right? Not really, no. The daemon cannot do it. A god could do it. You see the difference? God, well, I don't care about the laws of thermodynamics. I'll make my own. The daemon is, I'm subject to the laws of thermodynamics. This was an idea. Maybe the daemon is not subject to the laws of thermodynamics, but it still is. Make sense, everybody? So far, so good?
You can do it, but then you have to erase and do the whole thing again.
And it so happens that it coincides exactly the minimal amount of work that you need to erase it. It's the work that you extract from the contraption. So you cannot use the work for anything else than erasure. So you're not really extracting anything. Make sense? Everybody?
But the original problem that posed by Maxwell didn't have the problem of resetting the whole thing.
It did, only nobody thought of it.
Talk about the
nobody talked about memories, no. Keep in mind, I mean, information theory in the 19th century, without Shannon, nobody would have been able to find it very well, I think. Things are products of their time, except perhaps special relativity. There are very few things in physics that you say, whoa, where did this come from? In a way, it was a product of his time, but the way that, little note, the way special relativity or things surrounding special relativity was going, many people were working on the issue, on the issue of the Poincaré invariance of Maxwell equations, what's going on with mechanics. But those people were going, of course, people like Heaviside, people like Lorentz, Lorentz transformations, the first person who found it was Lorentz, right? They were very misguided in actually building the theory. And then arrives Einstein with an out-of-the-box thinking. I mean, that thing was not a product of his time, but most things are. And I don't think Maxwell could have done it without Shannon first. Make sense? Again, that's an opinion. Eh? All right. So let's see, before we leave, let's see a little example of application of a classical logic circuit. One that is kind of fun. Let's do a calculator, a 2-bit adder. So let's see what this is. We want this circuit. This is a circuit that if you concatenate, it's going to give you a calculator that can sum. Make sense? Any number. So let's do it. Input and output. It's a thing with four. Look how nice. An example with four and four. And we don't have gates for inputs and for outputs. And we're going to build it still. The input is A, B, carry in, and D, why not? And the output is A, B, the sum, and carry out. So the idea of this circuit is get A and B and the carry in, add it up. If it's add up adds to more than two, then you have a carry out. So you'd return the sum, the original values, the sum, and the carry out. Now you can feed the carry out of this circuit to the next carry in, and then you have the next digit of the sum. Agreed, everybody? So what's the table of truth? We can build it with from logic. So let me just, oh man, I need so many inputs here. I'm not gonna fit. Well, I can try. And this one doesn't move anymore, right? Oh, it does. That's nice. In case I need more table. All right, so 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. And indeed, I need more. Sorry about that. Bit of an improvisation here. Okay. All right. 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0. Almost done. 1, 1, 0, 1. Ah, 1, 1, 1, 0. And 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay. All right, so what do we get as output? Well, this is all zeros, so this is the same as that, right? 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. All right, so the sum. In this case, the sum is 0. You can tell. In this case, it's 0. In this case, it's 1. Agreed? You have a carry in. Need to add it. So this one is 1. There's no carry out here, either. Same thing here, you get a carry in. So in the third one is 0, 1, 0. Where are here? Sorry. 0, 1, 0. OK, no, I didn't. It's 0, 0, 1. Carry in as well. So this is a 1 as well. What am I doing? 0, 1. There's a 1 here. Yeah. Oh, that's why, yeah? And let's forget, yeah. I don't know why this is ordered so funny. I guess it's because all the D's are placed to zeros and then you don't need to write the D's ones. Yeah, that's right. So because the D is irrelevant for the input, it's just a channel for the carry out. In the notes, we just left it at zero all the time. So we didn't care much about the other half of the table. That's why. Okay, so hopefully the logic makes sense. So I do ignore D, so this is a 1 as well, 0. Here is a 1 as well. Here is a 1 as well, 0, 0. Here is a 1, OK. Here's a 0 and a carry out. Agreed? 1 plus 1 is 2, which is 0 mod 2. And then you carry out 1. So this is 0 with a carry out. Agreed? And then you see how it goes, right? Hopefully. That makes sense? For example, this one is 1 plus 1 is 1 plus the carry out, then plus 1. So this would be a 1 and a 1 of carry out. That makes sense? And because D doesn't matter, we can set D to 0 and just have half the table. I should have done that from the beginning instead of being stupid. Makes sense? The 2-bit adder, how it works, I don't have to fill in the table. You know how it goes. How do we implement it? Let me draw it here. A, B, C, carrion, and D. All that I need to do, Toffoli here. Oh no, wrong control, my bad. All right, then control not here. There we go. And then here, a control knot. And then here, another control knot. If I copied it right. So this is A, B, sum, and the carry out. We can do an example to see that it works, that circuit works. Let's take the example, the 1110 case. All right. So we know this should produce 1 plus 1 carryouts. Agreed? So let's see. So this is a control knot, right? A doubly control knot. So this one starts being a 0 here, but then it becomes a 1 here because the two controls are activated. Agreed? So this flips. Nice. So we go to the next gate here, and then here we still have a 1. We have a 1 before it. And then we say, okay, this is a control knot. So the control is activated, so this flips, becomes a 0. Agreed? Now we get here, we get 0, we get 1, we get 1. Well, this doesn't activate because you need the two controls to activate. So this doesn't flip, so it's still a 1. Agreed? Then we get here, a 1, a 0. And then, well, again, the control doesn't activate, so this is still a 1. And this is a 0, this is a 1. Ah, this is a different case. The control activates, so this flips to a 1. Agreed? Everybody? We propagate everything and we get a 1, 1, 1, 1. So indeed, the sum is 1 with 1 carryout. It works, at least for this case. Make sense? Now, you could have many of the circuits and then feed the carryout to the carry-in of the next one, and then you have a 3-bit adder or 4-bit adder. Make sense? Everybody? So you can build a calculator that sums just with this unit circuit. You see, we can build things with gates that don't require the same number of inputs or outputs. We can do anything. That makes sense? Any questions about this? We can set D to 0 always, huh? In fact. Make sense, everybody? In fact, you need it to be 0 always. I just made the stupid mistake of writing D for once, but I maybe cross them out. Every time you see a D1, just don't consider it. D is always 0. Make sense? Now, questions that you can wonder. We're going to talk about in the next lecture about the quantum versions of these gates. In particular, we're going to see the quantum version of 2 of the gates on the board. We're going to see the quantum version of C0, and we're going to see the quantum version of Toffoli. We're also going to see other gates, the quantum gates. But of the 2-qubit gates and 3-qubit gates, that's all that we're going to see. So the quantum version, so in mind that you have the quantum version of Toffoli, and you have the quantum version of C0. That's why I picked these two for the other. One thing that you can wonder is like, well, if I build it with quantum versions of this, right? Now my inputs could be, for example, things that you can think. Maybe I can get some advantage by doing that. For example, things that come to mind. Now, here, it's a definite value to begin with, but what if I input a superposition of two values? Can I do more? Can I do kind of parallelization with that or something? See what I mean? Those are legitimate questions you can ask. One way of thinking of finding quantum algorithms could be, okay, give me a classical algorithm. What happens if my inputs and my gates are quantum now? Can I get better things or not? See, it becomes an interesting question to ask. The answer for this in particular is no. You cannot do this one by, you cannot improve on this one by putting inputs that are superpositions and things like that. But you see, it opens the door, or the gate, I guess, for thinking of new scenarios, right? Where you can actually have not just definite values here, but have superpositions and see what happens when you substitute these gates by the quantum equivalent. And by the quantum equivalent, meaning that, well, they will act the same way if these were eigenstates, but it will not in a superposition, as we will talk about. Make sense? So this is as much as I will tell you about classical logic. We're going to move to quantum logic and do our fun there. Any questions? Is this clear? Hopefully. Any questions? All right, so when the next lecture is going to be quantum gates. We're going to play with quantum gates and quantum logic a little bit. And after we see these quantum gates, the first thing that we're going to do is write the circuit. We're going to learn how to write circuit representations of quantum circuits, right? And we're going to do quantum teleportation, the circuit of. We're going to write it as a circuit of the protocol of quantum teleportation. That's going to be fun. And after that, we're going to see a proper quantum algorithm, the first one that we're going to see. It's called Grover's algorithm, which is a search algorithm that is faster than the classical search algorithm. And it works in a fun way and very fun to talk about because it has a geometric way of seeing it, which is very neat. You will also do Grover. You will also do Grover yourselves on the IBM computer. With more, I'm going to do a version here, Grover, with a few qubits only, but you're going to do larger qubits on the IBM computer yourselves, which is kind of cool. And the IBM computer, you actually input the circuit. So it's kind of nice that we have the circuit version to write, and you're going to have to come up with how to write the circuit and so on. And then also in two tutorials, you're going to do another hallmark quantum algorithm. It's Shor algorithm, prime number factorization. It's nicely connected with the cryptography part that we're going to see as well. But the Shor algorithm, it's not as nice to see in lectures. That's why it's a tutorial. It's hard work, and you're going to have to do the hard work. It's two tutorials, actually. Make sense? So this is our plan. And then after that, we will see a relativistic quantum information protocol, in particular quantum energy teleportation, which I think is pretty fun, although I'm biased because I like it a lot, and I work on that. And after that, maybe I'll give you a little talk about fun things that you can do with RQI and quantum energy teleportation. And then the final lecture, we have a discussion. How about that? Where like you drive the discussion. You come up with, the homework is going to be to come up with cool questions to ask. They don't need to have an answer or know what the answer is, right? We can discuss together. And I can tell you like when you ask me about programmability, I actually don't know the answer. But it's going to be fun to discuss, I think. All right, OK, see you Friday.